Welcome back to The String. I'm Craig Havokhurst, and I'm exploring an exhibit at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum that's proven so popular it's been held over through the end of 2017. Dylan, Cash, and the Nashville Cats is an immersive experience depicting the time around 1970 that the wider world got hip to the mastery of Music Row and the quality and vibe of its recording studios. What had been a somewhat insular world focused mostly on country music became a destination for some of the most popular and influential artists of their day. Bob Dylan, recording Blonde on Blonde, for example, followed by visits from Simon and Garfunkel, Leonard Cohen, Linda Ronstadt, and others. But here, the emphasis isn't so much on the stars as the sidemen. There's a stand dedicated to the life and career of Charlie McCoy, who we met earlier in the show. There's also guitarist Wayne Moss and Grady Martin. There's a station for drummer Kenny Buttrey and steel player Lloyd Green. Each of more than a dozen musicians has six extended song samples that visitors can listen to with the push of a button. It's a rare focus on the instrumentalist behind the singer, but crucial to the sound of so many recordings that have stood up to time. Pete Finney was one of the curators of Nashville Cats, the only one who's a working sideman himself. The steel guitarist has worked with the Dixie Chicks, Vince Gill, Reba McEntire, and many others. I caught up with him and asked for an orientation to Nashville Cats.
My take on it was how Bob Dylan coming here in the late 60s sort of put a hip cachet around Nashville musicians, which was already there to the people that knew, but it opened the world of Nashville recording up for the folk and rock recording scenes of the late 60s, which just culturally were 100% on the other side of the divide from Nashville and country music and everything it represented. But it led to a 4 or 5 year, what I think is a golden age that the exhibit tries to represent.
But the experience is one driven by individual musicians, sidemen, who actually played the bass, the keyboards, the drums, and that made it one of the most original exhibits I've seen in Music City.
Right. That's really what drove the story for me. And ironically, people think that because I'm a working musician myself, that I'm the one that pushed the museum into making it about the sidemen and less about the name artists. And it was kind of the other way around. I sort of had to convince them in terms of, well, why would we want to do an exhibit on Bob Dylan, say? And I said, it's really not about Bob Dylan. It's about the musicians being so good that it drew him repeatedly and eventually drew many of his compatriots and contemporaries to also record. So the musicians are the core thing. We cover a lot of artists that people know about, from the Byrds and Sweetheart of the Rodeo and Neil Young, and sort of big names and some much lesser names, or people that would never have been associated. The common thread to all of those is the musicians, and the way the exhibit's laid out makes that crystal clear, because all the other stories are around the edges. You walk around and you see all this, but if you look towards the middle of the exhibit, you see giant portraits and biographies, and hear music by 16 of the key session players. So it's geographically laid out to make sure it's obvious that the musicians are central to our story.
And name some names who had to be in there.
Charlie McCoy, obviously. Norbert Putnam, both as a bass player who shows up on so many of the sessions by I call outsider artists, the non-mainstream country artists that recorded here. It seemed like a surprise that they would record in Nashville. David Briggs, who was the keyboard player who was Norbert's partner in Quad Studios later on. Buddy Spiker as a fiddle player. Mm-hmm. Lloyd Green, Pete Drake as steel players.
And these would have been people that the musicians themselves, the Paul Simons, the Neil Youngs, would have known about from records and talking among colleagues. But the listener at home who loves the records, these are invisible people to them.
Right. And that's one of the things that came out right away when we were talking to Wayne Moss, is another one. He's a guitar player, very, even perhaps less known than the names I just mentioned. And one of the main things he said is that, you know, they played on hit records by everybody from Perry Como to Chet Atkins to every hillbilly singer ever, and never got their names on the records. It's just the way things were. Motown was no different. Atlantic Records, for the most part. A lot of the anonymous recording scene, up until the late 60s, they rarely put the names on the album. And several of them credited Bob Dylan as being the first one that they recorded with, because Blonde on Blonde listed all the credits. And that sort of opened the door. And within a few years, I think it was fairly common for even country albums. They were proud. They realized that the musicians were a selling point. They weren't a distraction from the main artist.
So people have probably heard that term, the A-team. And are we talking about the A-team? Is there an A-team? How does that phrase resonate and click together with the exhibit?
I think the phrase A-team was really only valid, and when it first was being used, it was really only valid maybe in the late 50s and early 60s, where there really was a limited enough recording scene here where the top producers, who would have been Chet Atkins and Owen Bradley, would have hired basically the same players, no more than one or two on each instrument to do each session. So there was an A-team that you could list, and they've been recognized by the Musicians Hall of Fame, and some of them are in our exhibit. What started to change was, before the influx of rock and folk people that we talk about, but country music got successful enough in the early to mid-60s that there was more work. Three musicians moved here from Muscle Shoals because of the work was growing, and it expanded what was known as the A-team. And Norbert Putnam, who's in our exhibit, and David Briggs and Jerry Kerrigan, the drummer, the three of them, moved here. And it expanded, and I would say, and I think other music historians would back me up, that when you get to the mid-60s, there's no longer possible to speak of an A-team. There were probably three or four players who could fit that description, and probably three or four more on each instrument who were working full-time as musicians. And that's somewhat continued to the present, and we'll talk a little more about that.
The exhibit picks up essentially 20 years into the recording business in Nashville, the birth being 46, 47 Castle Recording within the confines of WSM, and using people who'd been live radio musicians on WSM who happened to have gravitated to the city, or in some cases had grown up there. And this would be a version 2 or 3.0 of Nashville's core recording.
Yeah, and again, it was the expansion of country music's popularity that led to more and more labels, more and more people chasing for success, and whether there was room on the radio for all of them or not, there was a lot more recording. Songs were being written to feed the greater number of recording artists, so demo sessions, which also are a lesser-known fact of keeping recording musicians alive, which is making demonstration recordings for songwriters to try to get the artists to record them. So the same guys, in many cases, who were playing on the hit records, on if they had an open afternoon, we're playing on demonstration recordings. And that's, up to the present again, is a huge part of what feeds the chance for people to be full-time recording musicians and staying in town and making a living and not having to tour or do all the other things that people do.
A fellow named Bob Johnson's a big figure. As soon as you walk into the exhibit, we see Bob Johnson talking. Who was he, and what role did he play? Why is he so prominently described, and why do we hear so much from him?
He was a very boisterous, outspoken man from Texas who had worked around Nashville as a songwriter, and in the sort of the back parts of the recording industry, he pushed songs for Elvis Presley's recording catalog. He ended up in New York as a sort of fledgling producer at Columbia Records, and through somewhat of a quirk of fate and his own strong-willed desire to do this, ended up producing Bob Dylan's New York sessions, starting most of the Highway 61 album in 1965. This led to him meeting, he already knew some of the Nashville players. He famously introduced Charlie McCoy to Bob Dylan. Charlie played on one of the New York sessions. He used that as sort of a lure to get Bob Dylan to try recording in Nashville, because the players here were so good, and they were mostly the guys we're talking about, Charlie McCoy and Kenny Buttrey, the drummer who's in our exhibit, great, great drummer. Some of the other players were basically Dylan's age. They were in their early 20s, but they had a great deal of experience recording all styles of music, and they were also very quick studies, which fit Dylan's style of recording, which is not to spend a lot of fuss, but just to try to do it on the fly and spontaneously. Bob Johnson's role was to lure Dylan to Nashville. That success, he ended up heading the Nashville division of Columbia Records, which put him in charge of Johnny Cash, who he also produced. He brought Simon and Garfunkel here. He brought Leonard Cohen here, several other names. So as a behind-the-scenes figure, he's both really important, and he's also very irresistible. We have a lot of video footage in him. He's very, very charismatic, and He's not a man who lacked in self-doubt. I'll put it that way.
That's great. Now, Charlie McCoy's name has come up from you here a couple times, and in this hour we've heard in detail from Charlie himself. Why do you see him as a really important figure?
Oh, he's just such a genius musician. He plays so many instruments. He's central to particularly the Bob Dylan records. He played bass, he played harmonica if he had to, he played guitar, he played keyboards. He was often the session leader. I think he was technically the session leader on the Dylan sessions. Al Cooper was sort of Dylan's liaison from New York, and I think the two of them sort of worked together. But Charlie tended to be the leader on sessions he was on, which meant he did a lot of the roles of what we think of as a record producer in terms of shaping the arrangements and sort of guiding the conversation as the musicians together would shape the arrangements. Charlie McCoy was, somewhat schooled, and then further, I would say self-schooled. I hope I don't get in trouble with Charlie. He had some formal music education, and I think he probably furthered that a lot on his own. So he could translate between most of the arrangements in Nashville, I think this came out, our head arrangements. They're not written down on paper. That was sort of the guys got in a room, heard the song for the first time, and knew each other well enough and knew all the different styles of music that they could come up with something just different enough to catch the listener's attention without being so different that it would alienate radio. That was the genius of those players. And Charlie was, I think all of them would say, he was as good as it got and sort of epitomized. And he's on just all the names that we mentioned, almost all of those records he has some role in.
The exhibit is highly detailed. Each musician gets quite a bit of copy. There's a lot there. What would your advice be for somebody approaching this who was not already kind of a record geek and who was taking this in as a fan who's loved the records we've been talking about? But what would you say about orienting if you don't have the 5 or 6 hours that it would take to really soak it in?
Well, the exhibit's laid out. When you first come in, you get a little bit of introductory material that tells you what the story is and how a handful of people, Bob Dylan being one of them. The reason Johnny Cash is named in the exhibit is partially his friendship with Dylan, which helped draw Dylan to Nashville. Partially it was that Cash's open-mindedness and particularly his network TV show in the late 60s, where he brought many, many rock and folk artists that would have seemed, again, on the other side of the spectrum from what people thought of as country music, both musically and culturally, socially, during the late 60s. So anyway, you walk in, the first thing you see is a little bit of introductory material, and then we tell the story about Bob Dylan very briefly. Obviously, it's been told a lot. We emphasize the fact that he had been into country music from, that was his earliest musical interest, and that interest never really went away through all his other stages before he came to Nashville, and then it was only a few albums in to being in Nashville that he actually made a country record. But we tell his story fairly briefly to lead into, because we're citing him as sort of the catalyst for so many other artists coming, which is not really answering your question. If you go through the Bob Dylan thing, you have to sort of pay attention to see it in order. It's easy to sort of wander through and not quite get the story, but it is laid out chronologically if you look at the headings.
And just to wrap up, what's the status of the studio musician in Nashville today? It's still very, very similar to that dynamic, and is it a much bigger community now, or is what's the quick version of how things are going with the studio player today?
It's basically, there's no way to avoid the talking about how it's gone through several stages between then and now to get to where we are. Basically, we've talked about how from the earliest days into the 60s, there was enough work to bring more and more musicians to town to expand the pool of full-time session players. That continued from the 70s and into the 80s to some extent. I'm not sure it grew rapidly, but it diversified and changed over. A lot of players have like a 3 or 4 year lifespan at the top, and then people move on to different phases. But what happened is it grew and gradually, and then in what I call the post-Garth Brooks era, starting in the late 80s, but into the 90s and into the early part of the 20th century, it was a boom here. There was so much recording going on, and it was just the chance for having a really successful record that sold ten million copies. Just fueled all the record labels, had tons of artists, all the songwriting, the publishing companies, and so there was just a lot of work here. So the pool really, really expanded in a really dramatic way in the 90s and then into the beginning of this century. And then with the beginning of what I would consider two factors, and one is the file sharing and Napster and all that, that's, you know, has been widely documented, just took the bottom out of record sales that has never fully recovered. And the other thing is the advent of home recording, which meant that people could make their own demos of their songs and not have to hire six musicians. So it fell out rapidly, and a lot of people who'd made a living in the studio started going on the road. It knocked everything down a notch starting about 15 years ago, I would say. I might be a little off in that. And it's never fully recovered, and some people seem to think that the old scene doesn't exist at all, and it definitely does. There is a recording scene. It's a little more diversified. Some of it may be in home studios, but Music Row, Berry Hill, a few neighborhoods around town, there are people that get up every day and go in and make hit records. And that part hasn't changed.
Pete Finney, co-curator of Dylan, Cash, and the Nashville Cats, the exhibit's been held over at the Country Music Hall of Fame through the end of 2017.